Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Learner's Corner podcast. My name is Caleb Mason, and I am so grateful that you have decided to spend a few minutes of your day here with me in the Learner's Corner. And today, I'm honored to be joined by Justin Brierley to talk with him about a lot of things. But one of the things that we're going to talk a little bit about is his most recent book, which came out last year, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. The subtitle is Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. Now, here on the Learner's Corner, we want to create a safe place to have difficult conversations. We want to create a place to where we can disagree, but disagree respectfully, and we can have productive dialogue and learn from each other and hopefully grow a little bit more in the process as well. And that's why I have a lot of the conversations that I do on the podcast, is to continue to learn and grow, because this is also a place for lifelong learners, and that we can engage in all types of conversations, and we can learn from each other as well. Now, if you are also on this lifelong journey of learning, please subscribe to my Substack, to where I give different recommendations of some of the best things that I am learning from, some of the things that are just engaging my imagination or provoking my curiosity as well. And anytime that I have something that's really standing out to me, I shoot it out there, and all you have to do is, check out the show notes, put your email in, and anytime that I have something, it will come out to you as well. It'll get emailed to you, and it could be anything from a book to a podcast to a movie to many different things that are just make me think as well. Now, the person who is making me think today is Justin Brierley, and as I mentioned, today we're talking with him about faith and really new atheism and some of the things that new atheism provoked or created Christianity or Christian apologetics to deal with as well. So let me tell you a little bit about Justin, and then we're going to jump into the conversation. Justin is a freelance writer, speaker, and broadcaster who has become known for creating dialogues between Christians and non-Christians. He is passionate about creating conversations around faith, science, technology, and culture. Through creative use of podcasts, radio, print, video, and social media, he aims to showcase an intellectually compelling case for Christianity while taking seriously the questions and objections of skeptics. He worked in radio, podcast, and video for over two decades until until April of 2023. He was theology and apologetics editor for Premier Christian Radio and hosted the Unbelievable radio show and podcast, as well as the Ask NT Write Anything podcast. He is also, or was also, the editor of Premier Christian Magazine from 2014 to 2018, for which he continues to contribute articles. His first book, Unbelievable: Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, was published in 2017. And his new book is The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, was published last September. And currently he co-hosts the Rechanting podcast for Seen and Unseen, and is a guest presenter for the Maybe God podcast. And he has also recently launched The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God podcast documentary series, which we talk about as well. So without any further wait, here is our conversation. Well, Justin, I'm so glad that we were finally able to make this conversation happen, and I'm excited to have you on the Learner's Corner podcast today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, so, it's good that it's happening now. I know we had a couple of false starts, but it's great that we can make it happen.
Yeah. And, for being our first conversation, and, you've written this book, which kind of prompted, me reaching out, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And anytime that I have somebody on the show, I love kind of hearing about like their origin story in terms of some of the work and the art that they've created. And so I would just love to hear a little bit of what got you interested in this idea of just exploring faith and helping people understand faith better, or even exploring like just many of the questions that come with faith, and then maybe you could kind of tie it into what led to the book as well.
Sure. Well, I've been kind of in the space of hosting Christian atheist dialogues and conversations for a number of years now. A lot of people will know me through a show called Unbelievable, where I kind of started it really as a kind of way of dialoguing between Christians and atheists, because I felt there needed to be better conversations really between both sides. It was around the start of the new atheism that show got going on, first of all, on Christian radio in the UK, but then we moved into podcasting and eventually into video and so on. So it was kind of, my passion really for creating those kinds of conversations came out of the fact that I just felt too often, both sides weren't really meeting, weren't speaking to each other, didn't understand each other very well. So I was able to create a show where we kind of deliberately brought both sides together to create that better kind of dialogue. And in the process, I wanted, in a way, as a Christian, I wanted to kind of show that Christianity could stand on its own two feet, intellectually speaking, in terms of these dialogues and debates that were happening. But it also had the effect of, creating an interesting space where both skeptics and Christians felt able to dialogue and to kind of have these very open-ended conversations. So it was really valuable fostering that kind of a dynamic, often in a time when increasingly social media and everything was creating more and more kind of echo chambers where people would only really hear the same views as themselves. It became apparent more than ever that actually we needed spaces where you would genuinely be able to hear from a different perspective to your own. So that's kind of the background to sort of what got me into it, really. Just a year ago, I actually moved on from hosting The Unbelievable Show after 17 and a half years of hosting it, which was a really bittersweet goodbye to a show I began and nurtured and loved and everything. But it was the right time to sort of start on some new projects. So that led me, though, in many ways, that had all laid the ground for my latest project, which is called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And it's a book and a podcast series now that really looks at the way in which the conversation has changed over the last couple of decades, really, from the heights of the sort of new atheism, which was this very dogmatic, anti-theistic form of non-belief, which a lot of Christians responded to, me included, through things like apologetics and so on, to, I think, a more nuanced conversation now that's going on, where I've seen new atheism sort of wane in many ways and a new conversation begin, even among non-Christian secular intellectuals, but who are reassessing the value of Christianity, and they're coming to some quite interesting conclusions about it. So the book and the podcast series, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, is kind of tracing that story, really. Mm-hmm. I'm having a lot of fun kind of telling that story and seeing what happens.
Yeah, there's a lot there that I want to follow up on. whenever you first start in like Unbelievable, and then even hosting or even just thinking about setting up these conversations between atheists and Christians and exploring all of these different topics, was there a particular conversation that you saw Christianity missing out on that sparked this thing? Or was it like a specific event that you saw or witnessed that got you thinking, okay, someone has to set up these types of conversations? Or was it just more of a gradual thing?
I think it was kind of recognizing that I didn't want Christianity to live in a bubble, in a way. And too often I was seeing Christians who were just completely unprepared, I think, to encounter and engage some of the arguments that were kind of floating around in the popular culture. So I just thought there might be a good place for just modeling what a good conversation could look like between a Christian and a skeptic. If I'm absolutely honest, initially I didn't anticipate the secular audience, the non-Christian audience that also came on board, because at the beginning it was just a Christian radio show, and we were doing something quite radical at the time, which was inviting non-Christians on to have these dialogues and debates. It was only once we started podcasting that we really started to pick up a lot of non-Christians as well, who started tuning in and downloading. And that was fascinating, because that really changed the dynamic, because I really felt like, well, now we've got this kind of very mixed, diverse audience listening to the show. And I really felt the responsibility to try and shepherd that and do right by both sides of the audience. And just to treat both sides with respect, obviously, try and bring the best protagonists on from both sides, so neither side felt like they were not being represented properly, and to try and chair these things as neutrally as I could. You know, obviously I wouldn't hide the fact that I'm a Christian, but so yeah, that was kind of where it came from, a real desire to see Christians kind of, yeah, do better in terms of these kinds of conversations. Because unfortunately, as the new atheism sort of was getting going at that time, I would often see some pretty bad versions of responses from Christians, you know, which only tended to confirm all the atheists' worst fears about Christianity, you know, that these were, you know, there wasn't really any intellectual heft behind it, that you know, there was this knee-jerk kind of fear response sometimes, I think, to people's beliefs being questioned and so on. And I just knew that Christians could do better than that. So that was kind of a lot of the motivation for why I wanted to host these kinds of conversations.
Yeah. What did you learn or observe or even still observe from your more secular audience, as opposed to like, and again, I guess, you know, it could be both things. Like, what did you learn about your Christian audience or from your Christian audience and from your secular audience?
I think from the secular side, I soon learned that, you know, atheists and secular people are very varied. So you can't sort of necessarily, you have to get to know each one to know exactly where they're coming from. There's all kinds of different reasons why people don't believe, lots of different influences on them. And so to that extent, what I learned in the process as well was that it's very easy to kind of respond to a cardboard caricature of someone and their argument. So, And that there's always that temptation on both sides, atheists and Christians, to kind of erect a sort of straw man. What I found, though, was that by hosting the actual conversations with real people in real time, you got a much more rounded sense of who people were and why they believed what they did. And I just think that kind of humanized each side more, allowed you to see, you know, the person rather than just the issue that you were debating. And one of the most valuable things for me was actually the fact that I came out of the whole thing with a lot of friends who were non-Christians, atheists. And that's really valuable, actually, because you realize that there's still a lot we disagree on. But actually forming relationships, I think, is the only way you really get to know someone beyond just kind of having the back and forth. I think I did learn a lot about, you know, interesting aspects of philosophy and science and history and the Bible. And, you know, I especially on the Christian side, because it wasn't just Christian atheist debates we had. I you know, ended up featuring a lot of inter-Christian dialogues and discussions between different perspectives in terms of theology and interpreting the Bible and so on. So it was just a huge learning experience in that way, kind of coming to see the breadth of interpretation that exists within the Christian church, kind of working out where I honestly fell, you know, in some of those debates and issues, and how that would then inform the way I brought my faith to a non-Christian and so on. So I was learning an awful lot the whole time, in all honesty. I kind of started the show, you know, very probably naive and ill-informed about many things, and I just learned as I went along from all kinds of really intelligent people on both sides, and was able kind of eventually to kind of bring this together in a way where I felt like actually I had something to say. So it was about 10 years in hosting the show that I wrote my book, which was kind of me trying to bring together my case for faith, kind of having chaired a lot of these discussions and had the opportunity to really think through some of the issues for myself as well. So yeah, those were some of the learnings along the way.
Yeah, you know, just as you were talking, it made me think about like what have you learned about like hosting good conversations, especially when there could be like you don't hope that there's going to be like really heated disagreement, but sometimes there is, and you're trying to manage, and also and imagine thinking about the audience and being like, okay, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's like the clarification between, okay, this is what you're saying and this is what you're saying, but you're misunderstanding,
each other. Yeah.
I would just love to hear what has helped you like navigate those types of like moderating conversations.
I think in all of the moderating and hosting I've done, I've always tried, I think that the central rule is to try and put yourself in the shoes of the listener. And the great danger was, as I grew in knowledge of the issues in apologetics and theology, that you could very often lose sight of the fact that the average listener isn't going to have been sitting in all of these debates. You know, and especially with a radio audience, you kind of always had to be very careful to make sure that if complicated terminology got used or anything like that, that you would try to help, you know, the average person to be able to engage with it. So a lot of my job was simply to make sure that the guests I was having on, you know, just were able to bring people along with them, weren't speaking at such a high level that, you know, an average mortal wouldn't be able to understand it. To kind of also anticipate the kinds of questions that I think the listening audience would have. So not to assume, you know, just because I might know what the answer to a question is, that the audience necessarily wouldn't. So to kind of try and create opportunities to encourage the Christian or atheist guests to explain themselves, to rephrase things. And overall, I mean, I felt I was there to facilitate a discussion. I wasn't there to make sure there was a particular outcome, to make sure that one side won over the other. I was there really to make sure that both sides got a fair hearing, that they got their kind of case out, that there was a fair kind of exchange, you know, that everyone got a fair say, opportunity to respond and everything else. And so that in a way, I think what I wanted to do was make sure that everyone had a good say, the audience understood what was being said, and the audience could then go away and make their own mind up on it. I wasn't there to sort of say, this is the definitive outcome of this discussion or debate. And so it was kind of almost treating the audience like grownups in that way. Not that they would know everything, because you have to kind of start where people are, but giving them the opportunity to weigh the evidence for themselves and see where they fall. So those were just some of the things I was trying to do in my hosting role. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And anything like whenever the conversation got intense, do you just kind of find that those like techniques and stuff that you were talking about, did you just use the same thing whenever, like maybe you knew that, hey, this person doesn't like this person, and it, you know, people's voices started raising, like, yeah. Again, and part of it is like, I'm just thinking about myself, because I've had to navigate things like that before, and I'm almost just asking for advice.
It's a really good point, actually. I think that there were, I guess I've always been something of a peacemonger, you know, what do you call it? Someone who brokers peace, you know. Mm-hmm. It's funny because for 17 plus years, I hosted a show which was basically about two different perspectives, you know, getting into a conversation or argument. But I myself am not an argumentative person. I'm quite conflict averse. But I think maybe that was a good thing for the show, because it did mean that I was always trying to find, you know, points of agreement as well as where the differences were. But I was also trying to, I think the important one thing that I found I developed an ability to do was to sort of take something someone just had said and kind of package, sort of summarize it, you know, and then hand it to the other person to respond to in a way that I think the listeners found helpful and helped to kind of create a good conversation between people. And when things did get tense between guests, I guess I was always trying to anticipate the right time to kind of sometimes just say something to kind of just slightly diffuse the situation if I felt like, you know, it was getting a little bit too tense, the right moment to kind of take a break or to change tack and do something different if I felt we were just getting into the weeds of something and not really making any progress. All of those things, I think, to some extent, you know, they're just things that you learn through experience. And again, you know, I was always dealing with the confines of a sort of an hour to an hour and a quarter of discussion. So I knew what I wanted to kind of, you know, cover in that time. So I was always aware that, you know, look, I've got a job to do here. I've got to make sure the wheels stay on this thing. If people start getting really annoyed or aggressive, that's probably not going to be good in the end. There's nothing wrong with a bit of friction and drama in that way. But I always wanted to land the plane, hopefully, in a way that was helpful for the listeners, where they didn't feel frustrated that it just went off and people just kind of got carried away or anything. So, in all honesty, there were probably times when I didn't do such a good job at that, you know, where things kind of got a bit out of hand and I never quite wrestled them back. But most of the time, I think with the experience, I was able to more or less, land these shows in ways that people felt like actually that was a worthwhile conversation, even if the guests, you know, disagreed very strongly or whatever. And sometimes I had to be, there were definitely times when I had to be more firm than usual to sort of make sure that person didn't just keep speaking, that I gave the other person opportunity to respond. Those were sometimes tough calls to make because inevitably, you know, if you've got two very passionate people, it can get like that. But yeah, I like to think hopefully I got the balance right most of the time and made sure that things stayed on track, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go back to what you mentioned in terms of pursuing this work with the surprising rebirth of belief in God / also re-enchanting. And, you know, again, I'm not looking for any like salacious details or anything like that, but I am very curious to hear your thoughts on, okay, so you go from doing this work in Unbelievable to you're wanting to move down this path. And I would just be very curious to hear like the distinction between the two for you of Unbelievable versus, you know, you're feeling that you want to work and maybe this new direction. And I would just be very curious to kind of tease out the difference that you see between the two.
Yeah. So in all honesty, you know, the original plan had been to kind of try to continue to kind of really to have a foot in with in Unbelievable, to continue to kind of do those dialogue type shows with Unbelievable. And it just didn't work out for various reasons. No. I was feeling kind of called to be able to work more widely outside of the ecosystem of Premier Christian Radio, where I'd worked for 20 years at that point. And so there was a kind of, it was just one of those things where there was, you know, it just made sense to start something new and to go in a different direction. Now, that doesn't mean I've left behind altogether, you know, having, you know, being host, moderator of things. I've done a few things where I have been in the middle of those kinds of conversations since. But it did give me the opportunity to just try something new for a while, at least. And I'd been really, you know, I'd obviously taken a couple of years, basically, to write this book that was being published last year. And almost at the moment where the whole thing, when it became clear that I was going to be stepping away from Unbelievable, and I would have more time on my hands, frankly, than I thought I was going to have. This idea for a podcast documentary series just dropped into my mind. And I just thought, you know what? I think there's a story to tell there. I'd really been enjoying some of the kind of documentary style podcasts that have been popular in the last few years. So the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, you know, adopts that kind of storytelling documentary format. The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, I'd been enjoying listening to. And I just thought, well, you know, maybe this is my opportunity. I would never have had the opportunity of the time, really, to be able to develop a series like that. And so that's where it came from. And so that summer I started working on it. And and I'm really pleased with the results. And it is very different. It's a completely different thing to Unbelievable. The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God series is, you know, it is like a long form documentary podcast. And I'm interviewing lots of people, you know, doing lots of editing, putting it together, creating a narrative. It's completely different to kind of the free form, you know, conversation dialogue kind of format. But I'm really enjoying it because I get to tell a story more, and that's what the book is, really. Having said that, I still am doing, you know, things like the Reenchanting podcast as well, which is more of your kind of standard interview type podcast and other bits and pieces as well. So I love still having that opportunity to do that. But I feel like I will go back as well at some point, having kind of had this nice time to develop some different things, stretch my legs in that way. I feel the call of coming back to me to do something in that sort of hosting those debates and dialogues again, because I really love the feeling as well of that, of feeling like you're really in the midst of something exciting when you've got two different perspectives going at it in that way.
Yeah. Talk to me about what you learned through doing like the documentary podcast, you know, either just in general or even just about yourself in that.
Yeah. So I think it is very different because compared to hosting these kind of open-ended conversations where you've obviously got a role, which is to just ensure that there's a, you know, both sides get their say and you kind of have a good conversation. This is much more guiding people, frankly, to a kind of an idea or a conclusion or a, you know, making an argument myself, really. And that's what I've done in the two books I've written. But so this was much more like trying to be as even-handed as I can be. But I'm kind of showing my colors more in this documentary series. I'm saying, I think I found an interesting phenomenon, which is this sort of the kind of rise and fall of new atheism, which is something I can kind of just document, I think, at more or less a historical level. But I wanted to kind of make clear that I felt like something was happening that was worth documenting and kind of putting my finger on, because I'd begun to see a lot of these interesting figures popping up who were not Christians necessarily, but were, pointing people back towards Christianity for all kinds of reasons. And I was just fascinated by that. And in a way, you know, I was hosting conversations with some of these people, but I didn't feel like any of it was quite pointing what was happening at a wider level. And I just felt like someone needed to do that. And I decided to do it. And that's really what the book was. And that's what this podcast series is about. It's trying to say, I think something's happening at a kind of bigger cultural level. And I've called it the surprising rebirth of belief in God. And I could be wrong, you know. And so there's a little bit of a kind of like, when you kind of put yourself into the story in the way I have, by kind of saying, I think I'm onto something here, you kind of open yourself up inevitably to criticism, to, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Pleased, maybe pleased is the wrong word. I've definitely felt that there's been confirmations of what I feel like I've been seeing in the culture just happening in real time. Even since I published the book, there was this really interesting story of Ayaan Hirsi Ali, a former new atheist, Somali born ex-Muslim, who was very much one of the new atheist speakers in the mid 2000s, published her own kind of anti-God, anti-religion book. And then she comes out with this extraordinary article in November saying why I'm now a Christian. And it just felt like in real time, what I was describing in the book and I'd just begun describing in the podcast was happening, you know, in front of my eyes. So it's interesting to kind of, to be able to do that, to kind of map out or kind of feel like you're contributing something meaningful to something that I think could be an actual historical kind of movement in that way.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is like behind the shift in new atheism, just as you talk about, literally in the title, to this rebirth of faith, this rebirth of belief in God? And I know you get into it a lot in the book, but you might.
Yeah, no, I'll give you a kind of, yeah, I'll give you the highlights. I think there were a few things that were behind the waning of new atheism. I think firstly, the reasons it kind of became such a phenomenon itself were a number of factors coming together. There was a certain sort of sense that religion, especially in the wake of 9/11, could do terrible things. And there was a kind of a movement against that. There was a lot of concerns, especially in the US, around creation and evolution, whether that was going to get taught in the classrooms. There was a sort of fears around, you know, the political religious right and that kind of thing. And then you had the birth of the internet, basically the coming of age of the ability for people who were formerly quite disparate being able to get together and find each other. And I think to be honest, there was a sort of, that was a lot of what was going on with the atheist movement, was just a lot of people found each other online and were able to form a community that hadn't really been possible before, especially in the USA. And that kind of had its in-person manifestations with, you know, atheist conferences, and we had something called the Atheist Bus Campaign here in the UK, which was this sort of quite, you know, public demonstrative form of atheism, red London buses bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." There was this publishing boom in new atheist literature, the God Delusion, God Is Not Great, and so on. And these four so-called horsemen of the new atheism. And so it was almost like a perfect storm of factors that seemed to just be the right moment for this very kind of in your face dogmatic form of atheism to rise. But it did fall almost as quickly as it arose. And I think it was for a variety of reasons. I think to some extent, in the end, New Atheism sought to tear God down, but didn't really erect anything in God's place. And people still had basically questions about, well, what am I here for? What's life about? And I just don't think that what was offered in the place of God, science and reason, was enough for most people. They're good for some things, science and reason, but they don't give you a purpose for life. And that's where I saw kind of a lot of people kind of ultimately kind of fade off, because they just didn't actually, the promises were a bit hollow in the end. Science and reason, you know, weren't enough to make sense of life. On top of that, you had a kind of internal conflict that started to occur within this new atheist community, where a lot of people who kind of had sort of had a honeymoon period where they all agreed God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, but suddenly found that once they were all agreed on that, they couldn't agree on anything else. And you had different factions developing, some who wanted to take it in their so-called atheism plus direction, where it was not just a commitment to science and reason, but also to certain things like, you know, LGBT rights, feminism, and so on. And others who said, no, this is a bad idea. We should just be about, you know, science and reason and not about any political ideology. So you had this kind of fracturing of the movement. A lot of people fell out with each other. There were some pretty big arguments, to the point where a lot of these atheist figures were no longer willing to share a stage together. You had atheist conferences being cancelled, and the movement kind of all kind of imploded in on itself. So it was, obviously there were debates going on with Christians, you know, between the atheists and Christians, but nothing in that realm matched the actual vitriol that the new atheists had for each other in the end, when some of this stuff happened. So I was kind of watching all this from the sidelines. And I think the lesson for me was that there's something about, you know, the fact that people are just very inherently religious, and even the new atheism took on a kind of quasi-religious nature. And that was kind of what drove it apart as well, because some people wanted effectively what had become a sort of quasi-religious thing to take it in one direction, and others wanted it to take it in another direction. And so in the end, you know, I think it failed for those reasons. And I think it left a kind of vacuum behind. And the problem is that, as I say, people are inherently religious, and other kinds of religious stories tend to fill that space. And I think what the new atheists didn't realize was that what they were doing effectively, by kind of sweeping the stage clean of the Christian story, they were just opening up the possibility of lots of other types of quasi-religious stories to take its place. And I hear a lot of the new atheists now kind of almost bitterly regretting, actually, that something worse, frankly, than Christianity is coming. A lot of them are really concerned about the kind of very progressive ideologies that are now in part of academia and are right in their backyard, which they see as far more pernicious in a way than, you know, a fundamentalist Christian church down the road or something like that. So it's very interesting to see the way the cultural shifts have happened. And it's made some interesting bedfellows of people who would once have seen themselves as kind of enemies, you know, actually on a lot of cultural issues. Some conservative Christians and atheists are actually on the same page now, you know, whether it be like on the transgender issue or something like that. So a lot of changing grounds happening, and that meant the conversation changed a lot in the process, and a new conversation began from people who were kind of willing to give Christian faith a second look, because they kind of saw the way in which atheism had sort of failed essentially to do that. And so that's kind of what a lot of the rest of the book and the series is about these new secular thinkers who are basically saying, well, look, maybe we should reinvestigate this story again.
You know, I'd love, like, you just got me thinking, and I'd love to have you elaborate a little bit more on this dynamic, because, and again, just what I'm hearing and what I'm thinking is like, okay, so in new atheism, or in atheists, you know, you point towards Christianity, and, you know, maybe you try to tear it down, or maybe say, hey, that's not the solution. But it almost seems like they didn't have like an alternative solution, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. didn't go like, hey, you know what, this is the better solution. And then they're kind of left holding the bag and going like, oh, mm. no, something else is coming to try to replace that.
Mm.
And it seems like And again, I'm probably very oversimplifying, but it almost seems like they didn't think through what they were doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's something like the law of unintended consequences, you know, when you, you know, there's that old, I think it's G.K. Chesterton who says, you know, if you come across a fence in the middle of a field and you don't know what it's for, don't just rip it down, because you'll probably discover later on that it did have a use. And I, you know, you'll work out that actually there was a bull that that fence was keeping in or something. And I think it's a bit similar to that with the new atheists. They kind of, they happily kind of tore God down, but didn't realize actually that that whether or not you believe in the religious story, it served a function. It has kind of given people a sense of meaning, purpose, and identity for millennia. And the question is, well, what are you going to replace that with? Because as I say, the problem was that science and reason, it just wasn't up to the job. And as I say, I think what a lot of them are discovering is that actually, now that we've torn God down, we don't have anything to put in God's place. And actually all kinds of other contenders are swooping in at this point. So that's why, you know, you have this interesting thing where Richard Dawkins now isn't ever really critiquing religion per se. He's critiquing, you know, stuff going on in his own field, transgender and so on. And whatever you think of that issue itself, the thing is that I think what he's realized is you can't, try as he might, try as the new atheist might, they can't extinguish a kind of a sense of the sacred, a sense of people will turn to something to fill that religious void. And very often it is these sacred causes, you know, around identity and sexuality and everything else. That might be the new kind of religious story that someone effectively is giving them their sense of purpose and identity and meaning. But the problem is, for Dawkins and so on, that kind of conflicts with his science, you know, with his kind of scientific account of reality. And so it's fascinating to see the way in which, yeah, sort of stamping down on Christianity over here and something else pops up over here. And it's like, and yeah, I've heard this from, again, a lot of new atheists saying, I think what we ended up realizing was that people are intrinsically religious, and you can't just sort of squeeze, you know, if you extinguish one form of religion, it'll pop up in another way. And actually a lot of them are realizing that what you end up getting, especially in some of the sort of, you know, some of the new ideologies, is it's religion in its worst form. It's very graceless. It's, you know, heretics are rounded upon with zeal. There's no room for forgiveness. So I think there's even a wistful kind of, you know, well, we were better off with Christianity for all its faults. Maybe we were wrong to kind of tear this thing down, because look what's come in its place, kind of thing. So that law of unintended consequences, I feel, has happened in the new atheists.
You know, and another thing that I wanted to ask you about, and I think I'm pretty sure this is a direct quote from your book, but you also write how our harshest critics are often the ones who help us to grow the most. And one of the things I was most interested in getting your take on is, like, what's one or two of the criticisms, you know, over the last, you know, 20 years, or even in New Atheism, that they had of Christianity that forced us to be better, that forced us to be more Christ-like?
Well, I think generally we can thank the new atheists for, as far as I can see, a kind of a genuine rebirth in Christian apologetics. Because I think for quite a long time, the church in a way had been asleep at the wheel when it came to kind of putting on the forefront the intellectual case for Christianity. You'd had people like C.S. Lewis in the 50s and 60s doing it, and one or two others. But by and large, I think we'd entered by the sort of 70s and 80s and 90s, a kind of more of an emotional approach, a more sentimental, arguably, approach to Christian faith. And not that there's anything wrong with that. I think Christianity has always been about the head and the heart coming together in a way. But I think that unfortunately, large parts of the church had kind of forgotten the intellectual core and riches, really, of the Christian faith. And so when the new atheists came along, I think it was a bit of a wake-up call. It was a rude shock. Once the internet started to kind of ask really difficult questions you know, it was harder for, say, young people, you know, that came through a church to maybe stay in a kind of Christian bubble and not to start asking hard questions and everything else. So, you know, when we've all heard about sort of the rise of ex-evangelicals and the deconstruction movement, all of that, I think, is downstream of just basically the way in which new atheism and the internet basically opened up a whole lot of questions. And the church was caught on the back foot because I think it had been so kind of focused on a more kind of experiential, emotional kind of component to Christianity. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's all you're offering, then you will struggle when a Richard Dawkins comes along and says, well, how do you explain science and faith? And what about the problem of suffering? And is there actually any evidence for God? And those sorts of things. So I think that was a necessary thing for to wake the church up and shake it out of its kind of intellectual slumber, and actually, you know, really did actually, I think, reinvigorate a lot of apologetics ministries, a lot of people who really rose to the challenge. And the irony is of the whole thing is actually that in a funny way, new atheism, as much as obviously a lot of people were persuaded by its message, there were, you know, a number of people obviously who would say they deconverted because they got persuaded by the likes of Dawkins and so. I've also met a good number of people who actually became Christians because of new atheism, effectively, where they, if it hadn't been for Dawkins raising difficult questions, they wouldn't have even bothered looking into it. But because they read The God Delusion, they happened to go and look at what someone was saying in response to it. And they discovered actually, oh, it turns out there is Dawkins' explanation of Christianity isn't the only game in town. So I have a good friend called Peter Byram who, you know, that's his exact story. He'd kind of, whatever faith he'd grown up with, he'd abandoned by the time he went to university. But it was because a housemate really got into The God Delusion that he started to read it. But then he discovered, oh, there are these people responding. And he discovered some good Christian apologetics. And so in a funny way, you know, I think we can thank Dawkins and New Atheism for kind of reinvigorating that Christian tradition, that intellectual Christian tradition. And even in a strange way, there are converts to show for that who might never have discovered Christianity were it not for that. So I think God works in mysterious ways. And personally, as much as I disagree with the New Atheism, I'm actually quite thankful for it as well, because I think it was a kind of a necessary kick up the backside that the church needed, you know?
Yeah. You know, I'd be curious to hear what's like, you know, you were mentioning, you know, 20-ish years ago or so, the church was kind of caught on our back foot in terms of what new atheism was bringing, or, you know, some of the issues and subjects that they were raising. Is there like anything that you see right now that, you know, is almost like a little bit similar, like things that maybe, you know, myself or the greater church or whoever, we need to be preparing for, like our conversations so that we don't end up like on the back foot. Like one of them that comes to my mind is like AI.
Yeah.
I would just be very curious to hear just your thoughts on that. Anything that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, and I think very often the problem is that the church can often just be behind the curve a little bit. And so the danger now is that we might end up continuing to respond to the new atheist questions when actually the conversation has moved on. And I think it has to some extent. So I think what's really important for the church to be addressing now, rather than those kind of specific theological and philosophical questions about God, is actually the existential questions people are asking, which is like, give me a reason to get up in the morning. You know, it's identity questions. You know, I think there is a huge identity crisis going on in our culture, people looking for, asking who they're meant to be and very confused about it, because all of the options, you know, have been thrown up in the air. There's I think in a generation of young people, there's a huge amount of that. And so the church has to navigate that. It has to help to ground people in a story that makes sense of who they are. And I think what we can offer to a generation that's suffering a kind of identity crisis is that actually it's always a mistake to put your identity in anything, whether it be sexuality, gender, or anything else, in anything other actually than the identity that you're given in Christ. That's the identity that actually is a kind of sure foundation, whatever else is changing around you. But I think that has all kinds of spin-offs and ramifications. I think part of the reason we are living through a kind of meaning crisis, identity crisis, is because of the proliferation of technology and the way in which that has kind of continued to kind of isolate people from each other in all kinds of ways. It's dehumanized us in all kinds of ways. And then, as you say, AI is like the next kind of logical step from that. And the way, and I do think the church, yeah, absolutely has to prepare itself and be ready to be a voice of, just a voice that helps to guide people through that, because there's a great danger that the church will kind of just assume, well, we just need to kind of preach the gospel and, you know, what will happen in the culture will happen in the culture. But actually, what's happening in the culture are actually extraordinary opportunities to speak into people's lives and about the way in which the Christian story interacts with these questions. The whole question of whether we are going to kind of surrender basically to a sort of the dehumanization that AI inevitably involves, of basically cutting the link between knowing what's real and what's not when it comes to human interactions, sort of the possibility of people effectively living out their fantasies and relationships with, you know, AI algorithms, that, you know, a kind of a an illusion of a wife or a girlfriend or whatever. All of that stuff is now a reality that could really happen, and there's a real chance that people are going to start to gravitate towards that because it's easier, you know, it's made so attractive. It's hard work doing the work of being a human and having relationships with flesh and blood people. And yet at the very heart of the Christian message is this idea that God became human. God did not become an AI algorithm. God became flesh. And so the church has to hold on, and it has to realize that we absolutely need to be at the center of that conversation, reminding people about what being human actually is, what a fully human person is. It is someone who is made in the image of God and is, you know, been sanctified by Christ. And for me, it would be a tragedy if the church, reneges on its responsibility to speak into the culture and show, just to tell a better story, you know, about what's happening in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got one other thing I want to ask you about, but before that, is there anything that we haven't covered, you know, just in the conversation, or just anything top of mind that you want to make sure that we talk about?
Not really. Great questions, Caleb. So I'm loving the conversation. I mean, probably the only thing we haven't really kind of touched in any detail is some of these interesting characters, you know, who are, I think, at the forefront of some of these interesting conversations. So some of the people I talk about in the book, for instance, are the historian Tom Holland, who, yep, I think is, you know, fascinating character who kind of came to realize himself the way, historically speaking, the West has essentially been founded on the values and virtues of Christianity. And again, is a really interesting secular voice, reminding a lot of his secular peers about what we're in danger of losing as we lose the Christian story. So that's just one example of one of these kind of prophets from outside the church, if you like. Another one, certainly controversial example, yeah, is Jordan Peterson, who, you know, a lot of people know, Canadian psychologist, but who, whatever you think of his politics and so on, he's a bit of a culture warrior. He has been drawing huge numbers. I mean, I was there with about 13,000 people, many of them young men, at the O2 Arena in London in November for a, you know, lecture he gave. And he basically spent a couple of hours talking about the Bible, basically. And so something's going on, you know, when a figure like him kind of is using that platform to point people back to scripture. And again, there are a number of other, you know, equivalent examples I could point to, where I just sensed that there's something the church needs to take from that. It's not that we need to hail Jordan Peterson or Tom Holland or anyone else as sort of the new Messiah or evangelist, but they're tapping into something that I think we should think seriously about ourselves, because they've realized, I think, that people are looking for something right now. They're looking for a story to make sense of life. And they're often, as I say, pointing them back towards Christianity. And so I think this is just a, yeah, just an amazing opportunity, really, for the church.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I want to talk with you about is actually, I would love to have you just elaborate on the quote, on this quote. And you begin the book, and it's Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. And, you know, he writes, "The interesting thing about the sea of faith is there's no reason why it can't come back in. The sea doesn't only withdraw, you know, it's the point of tides." And just as we wrap up our conversation, I would just love for you to just elaborate on just what's so meaningful about that to you.
Well, the particular sort of quote I'm using there comes from this poem, Dover Beach, by Matthew Arnold, a Victorian poet. And it's been often quoted. I'll quote it in full, though, the particular stanza. It says, "The sea of faith was once too at the full and round earth's shore, lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled, but now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar." And this melancholy long withdrawing roar of the sea of faith has been used as an image for the last 150 years, really, of the retreating tide of faith in the face of secularism, science, and so on. And in a way, that's only accelerated, you know, up to the present day. And a lot of people have been talking about the sea of faith going out and, you know, disappearing, basically. But it was, you know, a conversation I had with another of these interesting secular intellectuals, Douglas Murray, who basically quoted that poem by Matthew Arnold and said, but the thing is, Justin, the sea of faith could come back in again. That's the point of tides. And he was noticing among his secular peers an interesting number of people who were actually becoming attracted to Christianity, some who were even converting to Christianity. And he himself is an interesting character, Douglas Murray, because he was very much influenced by the New Atheists. We're both about the same age, graduated from Oxford University at the same time, and he lost his faith. And he kind of had a kind of public school sort of Christian faith, but he lost it, was went for lunch quite often with Christopher Hitchens, who kind of talked him out of it. And he hasn't found it again, but he now calls himself a Christian atheist. And the reason he calls himself a Christian atheist is that Douglas Murray came to realize that really all of the things he believes in when it comes to human rights, democracy, freedom, equality, human dignity, none of them are a product of atheism. None of them are actually a product of the Enlightenment or science or reason. They all basically come from Christian history, from the Christian inheritance of the West. And he realized that he was an atheist, but he believed in these things, these Christian virtues. And so he described himself to me as a kind of unsatisfied agnostic, basically. And I think he would like to see the sea of faith come back in. I think he's very worried about what happens, as we've said, when faith goes out, because all kinds of other things can come in and fill that void at that point. And so I just wondered whether we might be seeing a turning of the tide. As I say, I don't see this as a big kind of, you know, I'm not saying the churches are suddenly going to be overflowing. But I do just sense something's changing in the atmosphere. And I just feel like as the tide has gone out, I feel like it's reached its furthest limit. And there's a point at which it will inevitably turn back again, because I think people can only live on the diet of a kind of secular material story of reality for so long before it kind of runs out of steam. And I think people then inevitably do turn back to something that has given generations upon generations of people that sense of meaning and purpose and identity. And it is the Christian story that has, you know, shaped our culture in so many ways. So that's my kind of my hopeful sort of and conclusion really in the book is that we might be due for a turning of this tide, that Matthew Arnold's sea of faith doesn't only just go out, it could come back in again. And we may be seeing the first signs of that today.
Yeah. Well, Justin, I know that people are going to want to keep up with you and all of the work that you do. Where's the best place for people to go to do those things and keep up with you?
JustinBrierley.com is my website. You can get hold of the newsletter there. There's also links to the book if you want to get hold of a copy of the book, and also the new podcast documentary series. And I've been absolutely bowled over by the response so far to that. So lots of people sort of enjoying the documentary style of the podcast. So all of the links again, yeah, from justinbrierley.com.
Awesome. Well, Justin, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And just thank you for doing the work and for sharing it with us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Caleb.
So I think coming out of that conversation, there's a few things that stand out to me. One is just what he was talking about in moderating debates or moderating different conversations to where there's different points of view in it, and learning the places to interject and the places to continue to give room and air for the conversations to play out as well. But I really think the thing that two things really stood out to me in it is, one is the quote that I mentioned whenever we were talking about critics that our harshest critics are often the ones who help us to grow the most. And it's not a surprise. I think there's a tendency in all of us to want to avoid our critics, to avoid criticism. But it's in those areas of critique that we're able to grow. And that's why it's important for us to pay attention to criticism. And in this case, it's important for Christianity to pay attention to what its critics were saying. I think also for churches, it's also important to pay attention to the criticism that you're receiving, and even personally as well. And that doesn't, I think, necessarily mean that you have to pay attention equally to what everybody says. Not all criticism is equal. You know, you have to pay attention to the person who's also critiquing you as well. But I think there is something that we need to pay attention to regardless of, okay, what's the kernel of truth? We should be searching for that as well. And as Christians, we should not be afraid to do that, because just as Justin was talking about, you know, our identity is not found in our performance. Our identity is found in Christ. And I think we can learn a lot from our criticisms or from the critiques that are being made against us. And it also makes me think that we can't assume that, you know, for new atheism, okay, those were the questions that were asked then. Those are the critiques that were being leveled at them, and there is still truth in that, but things change, the landscape changes, and we need to respond and change with the landscape, and not assume that things have a chance. You know, it makes me think of this quote, and I can't remember who it's from, but it's just this quote of, the map is not the territory, and that our assumptions of what we think the land is doesn't necessarily mean that that's what the land is like. And sometimes we can use old maps that were once true, but they're no longer true. And it just makes me think of just the important, and again, what we talk about all the time on the podcast, of being a learner, of being someone who's curious, who's interested in growing and learning and all of that. And that's true for not assuming that the questions that were true of new atheism, that they haven't morphed, that the questions of today haven't morphed. And we, you know, obviously we talked a little bit about that as well. So those are a couple of things that I'm thinking about from this conversation. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to my Substack, and you'll get all sorts of, resources of some of the things that are making me think, that are engaging my curiosity, some of the things that I'm trying to learn about. I'm trying to make better maps of as well. So with that, I do want to say thank you to Sam Massey for creating the music for this podcast. Thank you to Justin for being on the podcast and for the wonderful conversation. And thank you for listening all the way to the end of the episode. My name is Caleb Mason. And until next time, keep learning and keep growing.